We recall Monty Woolley as the man who came to dinner and stayed on and on. Elijah, of course, is the man whom we invite to dinner, but who never attends. Every Seder night when we open the door, we look into the darkness, and he's not on our front stoop. For Elijah was, in the piety of the Middle Ages, the herald of the Messiah. And it was perfectly natural that our people, when they celebrated the first great deliverance from the anguish of history, should think to look ahead to the ultimate deliverance from the burdens of life. Elijah was to our people not only an historical character, but an existential one. He had lived and he was alive. Elijah comes as close to being in our folklore a guardian angel as any figure which is dealt with within our tradition. He is part Merlin, part Good Witch of the North. He is the protector of the pious and of the poor. He has 1,000 disguises. And when the good of the earth are confronted with overwhelming tragedy, he suddenly appears as if out of nowhere, and he brings about their deliverance. And so tradition tells us that Elijah can be a Roman senator dressed in the white linen toga of his rank, who will suddenly stand up to Caesar and say that the Judean scholar who is being tried before the dictator's court is not guilty of having contemned Roman law in favor of the unique law of his own people. Or he is an Arab physician who suddenly dismounts from his horse in the countryside and brings the relief from pain to a Jewish peasant whose illness is exacerbating. Or again, he's a Polish peasant who will work side by side with a Jewish innkeeper who has been ordered to cut and bundle so many units of wool under a penalty of death, ordered to do so by the local nobleman. Now, our people delighted to see Elijah in every unexpected deliverance. But we could not, being Jews, simply tell tall tales about Merlin without turning him into a Muhammad, without making our guardian angel into a pretty good school teacher. And so it is that the stories which are told about Elijah have a very heavy and significant moral basis. It's told that Elijah in the 4th century delighted to meet and to discuss the intricacies of Talmudic law with a certain pious scholar by the name of Anan. Anan was a good man and a careful jurist. One day a neighbor and a friend brought him a small present, a bit of fish delicacy. And Anan bethought himself that this neighbor had a case which was on the docket, which sometime in the future would come before his court, and he turned the present down, lest he be swayed in judgment, which of course was the proper thing to do. But the neighbor was so eager to make this present that he said, "Look, you take it. Recommend me to some other court where the judge will be impartial, and I'll take my case to another venue." And Anan accepted the fish and wrote a letter of recommendation for this man to a fellow jurist of note. But having received this note from a man of Anan's stature, the jurist could not help but be swayed somehow, in a very pervasive yet unexpected way, the balance, the scale of justice was swayed. And Elijah pointedly refused to come to talk with Anan anymore. We know of Akiba. It's one of the classic and grand intellects of our tradition. We often forget that for the first 30 years of his life, Akiba was an illiterate peasant. He could neither read nor write. But he had the good fortune when he was in his 20s to fall in love with the daughter of a local landowner. He thought that this was such a terrible mismatch that once the young people were married, he disowned his daughter. And Akiba and Rachel were forced to live in most abysmal and abject poverty. By and large, the warmth of their love was sufficient to carry them through the greyness of their days. But every once in a while, the burdens of life overwhelmed them, and the flame of their love was not sufficient to warm the dismal and dank night. And one such night, a beggar appeared at the door, Elijah. "Please, please God help me. My wife has just delivered a child, and I don't even have the straw on which to lay the baby to make a cradle for him." Akiba and Rachel were able to tear apart their mattress and to give some straw, and in the giving, in the concern, in the solicitude, they found again, of course, that life is worth living and that even the most abject of people can rejoice in helpfulness to others. And so Elijah taught Akiba and teaches us that we must not only be concerned with the material well-being of others, but with their inner and psychic well-being. Perhaps the classic story about Elijah as a teacher was first told in medieval Eastern Europe. It was told about a certain Baroka who must have been the president of the Chamber of Commerce of some little town in the Pale of the Settlement. Baroka was a good burgher. He liked his fellow citizens, he thought himself respectable, and he respected them. They were pillars of the community, outstanding citizens. He was proud of his town, and he didn't miss a chance to brag about it. But one day, Baroka chanced to meet Elijah in the marketplace of his city. And partially out of innocent confidence and pride, and partially out of not-so-innocent inquisitiveness, Baroka turned to Elijah and said, "Who of all those fine people there thronging the marketplace is going to merit a place in paradise?" And to his absolute astonishment, Elijah answered, "No one." There was absolute silence. Baroka didn't know what to say. His world was shattered. And then Elijah touched him on the shoulder and said, "You see there, over there?" Baroka looked, and there was a rather gross, loutish-looking fellow coming out of a back alley. He said, "That man will merit paradise." Well, Baroka's world had crumbled at his feet, but when Elijah says something, you listen to Elijah. He speaks the truth. So Baroka went over to this man and said, "Tell me, you have wonderful letters of recommendation, though I can see nothing that justifies what I've heard of you. Tell me about yourself." And the man answered, "I'm a bailiff, jailer. And I really am a very unpretentious man. I can make no claim to virtue except this. Within the jail, I've always seen to it that the paupers and the debtors, the people who are innocent of any real wrongdoing, are separated from the hardened criminals. And I've seen that the young people who are brought in for their first misdemeanor are kept separate from the felon and the man who is back here again every month or year or so. But why don't you dress as a Jew? Why don't I see you in the synagogue?" Oh, he said, "That's easy to explain. If I dressed as a Jew, if I were known as a member of your community, the ruffians would soon stop talking in front of me, and I wouldn't be able to tell the rabbi when I ever heard some plan to rob the communal treasury or to commit theft against some Jewish person." Baroka understood then that you're not to judge another man by his appearances. And the same story, interestingly, was told in another community about Elijah and about Baroka. But now the hero of the story is not a jailer, but two clowns. Circus people, actors, gypsies, as you know, were the riffraff of Europe. They were outside the pale of society. You wouldn't invite them into your home. You wouldn't take a look at them. You wanted their skill. You wanted to laugh at them occasionally, but you wanted to have nothing to do with them. They were thieves and scoundrels and worse.
On this particular day, Elijah said to Barakah, "There's no one here among your respectable fellow citizens who merits paradise, but look you there." And he pointed to two white-faced clowns made up to amuse the mob. And Barakah said, "Why these clowns?" And Elijah answered, "Because they bring laughter into the bitterness of life and light when life is shadowed over. They make people forget the pain and the anguish and the torment of being, at least for a moment. And they ask very little in return. That is why they deserve paradise." And so in our tradition, this existentialist Elijah is part guardian angel, part magician and good fairy, part teacher of morality, and part the herald of the coming of the Messiah. For when he appears, not to an individual here or there, but as himself, girded in the prophetic mantles, strong in his physical stature, the world will know that the time of Israel's travail is over, and that our people will soon be gathered together in freedom and dignity under a scion of the house of David. Next year, may it be in Jerusalem. But what about the real Elijah? What about the Elijah who lived in the 9th pre-Christian centuries in northern Israel during the reigns of kings Ahab and Ahaziah? What do we know of him? And here, interestingly, we know very little of a man stripped of miraculous power, a man such as you or I, who lives and works and uses his mind and his hands and his skills. For even in those original documents, there is something of the mysterious, something of the awesome about the figure of Elijah. The very way in which the story of Elijah appears in the Bible is strange. The book of Kings, from which we heard read this morning, the book of Kings which tells the story of Elijah, was written by and large in the 7th and 6th pre-Christian centuries by a group of editors known as the Deuteronomists. The Deuteronomists were Judeans, southern Israelites, who believed not only in God and in the covenant, but most especially in the importance of Jerusalem as a center of the cult, in the importance of the priest class, the sons of Aaron, as those who were who controlled the cult, and in the importance of the descendants of the house of David to the proper government of Israel. And they wrote the political history of Israel in terms of these sets of values. Now, their history comprises the book of Kings. And the first 16 chapters of the book of Kings and almost the entirety of the second book of Kings are written entirely by their hand. But when we come to the 17th chapter, abruptly, we come across a much older document set into this Deuteronomic writing, a document which tells us only of two men and of the events of their lives, the man, the prophet Elijah, and his disciple, the prophet Elisha. And both men are wrapped in legend and girded with mystery. Elijah comes unexpectedly on the scene of history. We know nothing about him, nothing of his parents, nothing of his background, nothing of his training. It's simply said that one day Elijah appears before King Ahab and announces, "The heavens are sealed. There will be no rain in Israel a whole year." We're not even told the reason why God has ordained this drought. Then we are told that Elijah, to escape the wrath of Ahab for having uttered such troublesome news, he goes to the lands east of the Jordan. He lives beside a brook which gives him some water, and he is fed by the ravens with his morsel of food. And then when the brook dries up and the ravens no longer can bring him food, he travels west and north to Phoenicia. He lives with a rather destitute Phoenician woman, a widow, who takes him in and befriends him and gives him what little she has. And in gratitude, Elijah performs a series of miracles for this widow woman. He takes her meager pantry and he allows it to last during the entire period of the famine brought on by the drought. He takes her meager supply of oil and becomes sufficient for a year or more. And when her son dies of some unspecified disease, he manages to revive the child, to breathe back life into him. Now, how shall we deal with a man about whom historians almost contemporaneous with him, spoke of him as a miracle worker. They could not parse him down into an ordinary human being. Well, one way is to say that the Bible does not say what it does in fact say. And thus we can emend or reread the biblical text. Elijah being fed by the ravens. Hebrew word for raven is oravim. You can vocalize the Hebrew differently and make it say aravim. That Elijah was not fed by the ravens, but he was fed by Arabs, by desert people who chanced to be by. Or you can say that the story of Elijah is simply a tribute to the credulity of ordinary people. The fact that there are in every generation uneducated people who see what look to be cause and effect and are simply chance occurrences and who assume that they are miraculous because they don't fit natural law. There are people who assume that a religious man must be a miracle worker, that an evangelist must be a faith healer. These kinds of people are the people who wrote about and who were attracted to Elijah. And in fact, the Bible tells us that this widow woman, this Phoenician woman, after all these miracles had been performed on her behalf, she says to Elijah, "Now verily I know that thou art a man of God and that the word of God which is in thy mouth is truth." And interestingly, as a sidelight, when the writers of the New Testament came to embellish and to add to the biography of Jesus, they could not resist stenciling on to Jesus' history miracles identical to the miracles which the Bible ascribes to Elijah and to Elisha. They turned Jesus into Elijah in order to prove that since he had performed miracles, therefore his word must be trustworthy. And in the Gospel according to Luke, we read that the people confuse Elijah and Jesus, assume Jesus to be his reincarnation, because these same stories are being circulated now about this new religious leader who feeds the poor miraculously, who heals the ill, and who revives the dead. But you know, once you have said all of this and offered all these explanations, you're still left with the enigma, the man. The way in which quite capable historians in his day saw him. And I think what we're left with is the simple fact that there are men who do seem to be able to do that which is miraculous. There are men who can lay on the hands and heal the burden of illness. There are men who can look you straight in the eye and somehow compel the truth, who understand what you are thinking. And there are strange people who seem to have the capacity to look into the shadows beyond and to describe something of the future. And there are men who, when they denounce their world or their nation or someone, you hear the thunder and lightning roiling and rolling in the background. And Elijah must have been such a man. There was something which was commanding, which was cosmic about him. And you cannot deny this to his biography simply because it appears to be written by credulous people and to be filled with legend. And it is. But it is not for this cosmic quality of his that I list Elijah among the founders of our faith. I submit that he is one of the founders of our faith because he is the prototype of the prophet. He is the prototype of that unique Jewish religious spirit, which was the most dynamic and most meaningful contribution of our people in biblical times to the history of civilization. Haddalah, the ceremony which separates the holiness of the Sabbath from the mundane quality of the work week. The Haddalah service of our people concludes with the kiddush and the extinguishing of the candle which is burnt the day long. And then our people will want to sing the lovely little hymn of messianic hope, which begins, Eliyahu Hanavi, Elijah the prophet, Eliyahu HaTishbi, Elijah who came from Tishbi, Eliyahu HaGiladi, Eliyahu from Gilead, Eliyahu, Eliyahu, Eliyahu. Eliyahu Hanavi. Elijah was the prophet. And what I'd like to do in the few minutes that remain is to explain and to make clear how Elijah is the prototype of the prophets of Israel. He is the spokesman of God. He comes and announces in the name of God that the heavens are sealed, there will be no rain for a full year. And though the text does not make clear why this statement is made, we soon learn that God is punishing Ahab and all of the northern kingdom of Israel because they have turned to idolatry. Omri was a general. He was the father of Ahab. Omri was one of the mercenary generals who were thronged to the court in Samaria, in the north, and who managed to wrest the northern kingdom's control away from the descendants of Solomon. Omri was a capable general and a capable administrator, and when he gained the royal purple and became king of Israel, he realized that the real enemy lay directly to the north in Syria. And knowing that Syria would soon attack, he tried to protect his flanks east of the Jordan and along the Mediterranean coast. And so he arranged a diplomatic marriage for his eldest son and heir, Ahab, with the daughter of the priest king of Phoenicia, a man named Ethbaal. And he married Ahab to Jezebel. Now, Ethbaal is an interesting person. He is the grandfather in history of Dido, the legendary foundress of the kingdom of Carthage. He is the father of Jezebel, she who troubled Israel more perhaps than any other woman in history. For Jezebel was not only a fair damsel and the daughter of a king, but she was a priestess of the god Melkart, the Greek god Hercules. And when she married Ahab and came to Samaria, she insisted that she bring her priest with her and that Ahab build for her in Samaria a temple to Melkart. And she began a lifelong attack upon the priests and the prophets of the one God. Now, Ahab acceded to her request, and within the sacred precincts there was built a temple to this heathen god. Elijah appears as the champion of the true God. He appears, as do all the prophets, determined to eradicate every vestige of paganism, every vestige of heathenism, every accommodation, every temporization by king or commoner with any worship which was less than the worship of Adonai. And there is in the story of Elijah a great symbolic story. Elijah challenges all these priests and prophets that Jezebel has brought with her to a contest. Let them bring their bullocks and their offerings and build a marble altar to their Baal, to their God on Mount Carmel, that great hill above Haifa. And let them invoke their deity and perform whatever orgiastic rites they perform. And he will build a small altar, and he will offer a single bullock, and he will pour simple water on the bullock and offer a prayer to God. And let us see which of the two sacrifices are accepted, the sacrifice of the god Baal or the sacrifice of the one God. And there is a story of the building of these two altars, and the priests of Melkart dance in frenzy about their holocaust, and they cut their wrists and let the blood flow on this altar in an appeal to Melkart to bring the heavenly fire down to light the pyre to accept the sacrifice. And their prayers are not answered. And Elijah comes and he offers the one bullock upon his simple altar, and he pours the water upon it, and the fire of heaven comes down and the pyre is consumed, and he has victory that day over the priests of Baal. It's a legendary story, but it's a symbolic story because it contains within it the challenge which was thrown at Israel by each and every prophet. How long will we crouch between two opinions? If God be God, follow him. If Baal be God, follow him. How long will we crouch between two opinions? How long will we be caught this way, going this way and that way, compromising, temporizing, God demands a zealous worship. You can't have it both ways. You can't make all kinds of bargains with heaven. Why not? Why could not Israel alone of the peoples of antiquity bring into its worship the pantheon of other nations? What was so despicable, so unacceptable about heathenism to the Jew? Simply this, that while the ancients worshipped nature, the power within all natural phenomena, that's what we mean by animism. Israel worshipped, yes, the Creator God, but the God who commands, the God who ordains the basic morality, the commandments, the covenant, life itself. And so interestingly, immediately this great contest at Mount Carmel is over. Elijah, fleeing the wrath of Jezebel, goes into the wilderness, travels for 40 days, where? To Mount Sinai. To the very place where Moses had received the commandments. And there he communes with God. And God says to him, "Wherefore hast thou come, Elijah?" "I have come," Elijah answers, "because thy people have forsaken the covenant, because they have contemned the basic law, because they have pulled down thine altars, because they have killed thy prophets, even my life they seek. I alone am left to speak the word of God." And God tells Elijah in one of the classic symbolic stories of the Bible, "Get thee up on the mountain and turn to the rock." And there came about a great wind, and the wind burst the rock, but God was not in the wind. And there came an earthquake, and it shook the mountain, but God was not in the earthquake. And there came a fire after the earthquake, but God was not in the fire. And then there came what the Bible calls a kol dumama daka, a voice of great stillness, and Elijah heard. God is not simply the natural phenomena, the power of the universe. He is the power within. Man's understanding of the moral law, of the spiritual duty. Here we have symbolically, clearly portrayed the unique command of our faith, which is that we cannot worship one aspect of nature or another. We cannot simply be overwhelmed by a sunset or by the power of the sun or by a stream or by the lightning or by the thunder. These are all magnificent. They all testify to the power of God. But the ultimate glory of God and the real reason to worship him is that God personifies to us the oneness of our obligation, the inescapable duty, the voice of great stillness which wells up within when we confront the daily decisions of our lives. Elijah represents then the conscience of Israel, its uniqueness. And he is the man who is willing to speak what he understands to be the will of God, the voice that wells up in this great stillness, whatever it commands, however popular or unpopular the words which he speak may be. Elijah does not tremble to stand up to the king or to a commoner. Here we have another unique quality of prophecy. The prophet represents the defense of the individual against absolute power. The prophet is the man who will stand up against corruption, against absolutism, against authority, and insist that there is no man, no king, no power above the law, that all must submit to the ultimate law, the law of God. And so we have told of Elijah that wonderful tale of Naboth and his vineyard. Naboth was a simple man, a vintner. He had a piece of land in Ephraim. It was a good piece of land, and the grapes that he grew on it could be turned into fine wine. And near his property, the king, Ahab, had a great vineyard. And the vineyard was fruitful, and Ahab looked towards expanding it, but he couldn't expand to the north because there was Naboth's piece of land. And he turned to Naboth, he said, "Sell me the land." But the custom was in Israel that one did not sell one's inheritance. This was all one had that could not be stripped from him, and Naboth refused the the request of the king. Nahab asked, pressed him and offered him a good price, but Naboth still refused. Knowing the ancient customs of Israel, Ahab retreated in dismay and began to pout about the palace. Now, Jezebel was raised in a different tradition. Jezebel was raised to assume that there was no authority besides the authority of the king. The king was divine. He made the law. Her father was the priest, the voice of the Baal Melkart. She could understand how a little Israelite peasant could stand against the wish of the king. But this was Israel, a strange land. These Jews, you could never quite understand them. So Jezebel went about it deviously. She hired two ne'er-do-wells, and she told them, come testify, bear false witness against Naboth, accuse him of lese majesté, accuse him of having been traitorous to the king. The court will convict him and execute him, and his land will eschew to the crown. His land will become Ahab's. And so it came about. These two people came, and they said that Naboth had spoken treacherous words, and he was a traitor. The court believed their testimony. Naboth was executed, and the land reverted to the crown. And the word of the Lord came unto Elijah and said, go up and say unto Ahab. And Elijah appears. And Ahab, who after all was a Jew, knew what Elijah would say before he said it. And Ahab said to Elijah, hast thou found me, O mine enemy? And Elijah said, verily in the place where the dogs licked the blood of Naboth, there will the dogs lick the blood of Ahab. Ahab was guilty of being a party to murder. The king, the queen were not above the law. And the prophet, though he might forfeit his life by speaking in this way to the king, was not behindhand when he felt that God insisted and demanded that the crimes of royalty be made clear. Ahab at one point calls Elijah Ocher Israel, he who troubles Israel. And I know of no better description than this of the role of the prophet. The prophet was the man who looked at his people and saw not their small decencies, their insignificant virtues, their respectability, but he saw their indecision, their tendency to compromise, their willingness to accept base versions of religion rather than the true faith, the ease with which they were put off from doing that which needed to be done, the right, justice, establishing freedom, protecting the poor. He came to trouble Israel, to summon Israel from somnolence, to summon us from the way in which we live, in abundance and affluence, freedom and opportunity, but carelessly and heedlessly, thoughtlessly. He would trouble the conscience of Israel. And then of Elijah, the Bible tells us that the time had come for him to die. And he crossed the Jordan with his great disciple, Elisha. And they spoke of this or that as they walked in the wilderness. And then suddenly, the horsemen, the chariots of heaven, and a great whirlwind, and Elijah went up in the whirlwind. Elijah never dies. He is alive, even as the prophets of Israel are alive. Prophecy ceased in Israel 2900 years ago. The last of these great religious figures was laid to rest. But they've never been laid to rest. Because this insistence on a revolutionary morality, this insistence that God is not satisfied with ritual or rite, with compromise or temporization, this insistence rings down through the centuries. Their words are still heard, even as the figure of Elijah is still seen before us
commanding and exalting the role of the prophet. This then is Eliyahu Navi, Elijah, forerunner, prototype, the prophet. Elijah, who challenged the conscience of Israel, who challenged absolute authority in Israel, who insisted on the pure worship of the one God, who called the prophet, called Israel to look back always to Sinai, to that basic covenant which establishes our relationship with God. Elijah the prophet, who was summoned to heaven in a chariot of fire, borne to heaven by the whirlwind, who lives in the heavens, who comes down now and again to the earth to succor the poor, to sustain the pious, to remind each and every one of us of the essential outline and command of our faith. And who knows, perhaps today after we leave this worship, as we look about our friends and the neighborhood in which we live, we'll recognize Elijah among our neighbors, among our friends, in the voice of one who offers good counsel, in the thought of one whose reason commands respect, in the acts of one who is impatient with the ordinary feeble compromises which comprise our lives. Perhaps we'll know, as did our medieval fathers, that Elijah lives, and take hope in that fact. Amen.